This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Ruled for 3 decades. I inquired about Juno's relationship with this history, since his own father served in the military police during Trujillo's regime.
Trujillo's regime, this terrible dictatorship of 30, 31 years. And in Oscar Wilde, you depict him as this evil, you liken him to Sauron from Lord of the Rings. But your father served in the military police in the Dominican Republic, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Talk about the experience of growing up hearing this rhetoric, while at the same time your politics are so polar opposite and in print.
I think part of what made my representation of Trujillo possible was that I didn't come from the valiant, heroic opposition. I was raised inside of the regime, deeply inside of the regime. I was in the apparatus in many ways. I was born after he died, but sort of my family was a, you know, pro-Trujillo instrument. And I think that was very important for my development. It was very important for the way I viewed the world. I was the farthest thing from a kid who would ever think about hurting other people, or who sort of would think that it would be kind of cool to, you know, terrorize folks. And I recognized sort of early on, when everyone would talk about Trujillo, that even the people who supported him were deathly scared of him. I mean, as a child, the one thing that you're really, really good at, you're almost like a dowsing rod for fear. Fear is one of these elements which, as a child, you try to do everything to avoid. And I could just sense the density of that fear. And I think from an early age, I understood that this was someone who had cast a dark shadow over the country and over the diaspora.
And how did your father react? I mean, has he read your books?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. We're sort of, all of us are estranged. I mean, by all of us is me and my siblings and my mom on one side and my father on the other side. I know he doesn't think very positively of my work. I had an embarrassing sort of public, I don't know, what is the English word? Kerfuffle, is that a word?
I think it's become one in the past few years,
Lord,
with Jon Stewart.
Is that where I get it from? Nugget, I watch way too much TV. So my old man, gone on the record and written up some op-ed piece on the treatment of the Dominican government, on Haitian communities and Haitian Dominicans within the country, the sort of abusive, sort of the way the state has been dealing with its immigrants. And I wrote this up and criticizing it in many ways, condemning it. And then the newspaper followed up and printed a letter from my father encouraging me and people like me to move back to Haiti. So I had the sense that we're on opposite sides still.
And move back to Haiti. That's quite a response.
Yeah, man. I was like, move back to Haiti.
Again, talking about your childhood, after you moved here, you were 6 years old?
Yeah. I was a wee lad. I was a wee.
And at the time, you know, you spoke Spanish fluently, or at least presumably on track with other six-year-olds. Tell me about the process of learning English and how your own Spanish changed over time.
Yeah, no, it's kind of the typical story. I wish there was some interesting wrinkles to it. It's one of those sort of dual track stories. On the one hand, I had an enormous difficulty learning English. I was immediately put into special education. In the early 70s, Central Jersey, there wasn't the kind of programs you see now, and perhaps that maybe in some places they don't have them, but now where I grow up, they have a lot of these programs, free ESL, they've got a lot of kind of resources, they've got a lot of people thinking, writing, and training around this area. When I came to New Jersey, they literally put me in the back of the class and were like, you had to learn through osmosis. And I got put into special ed. That was nuts. And then I had such difficulty speaking English. I guess, I don't know, it was kind of a traumatic experience that I was also, they also thought I had like something wrong with me developmentally. And so I was put into a speech kind of to correct my speech,
speech
therapy stuff. And that was also, really strange. And for a child, of course, troubling, you know, what you don't want to stand out. And then what happened, though, of course, is one of my reactions to, one of these reactions that you get is that you sort of begin to overcompensate. There's nothing worse than being an immigrant and not knowing a language. Eventually, when I turned the corner on this, probably 8 or 9, I began to overcompensate, what teachers call hyperlexic. I became a really incredibly strong reader, became very interested in English as a language. My vocabulary began to expand, outstrip almost all of my peers. You know, all the stuff that we do, again, because there's so much pain, at least in my case, there was so much pain. And I felt this was a way to kind of erase some of those early difficulties. On the other hand, I was growing up in a community that was primarily very transient. So you had a lot of white folks coming in and out and people of color coming in and out. But the people who stayed were African-American and Latino. And so I grew up with a very black English. And my friends that I grew up with, it wasn't like my black friends were like, let's practice Spanish together. And so on the other hand, my Spanish sort of disintegrated. And I only began to work on it when, you know, paradoxically or ironically enough, when I went to college. Now I'm pretty much fluent, though, of course, you know, my mom's out there laughing, you know, fluent. But yeah, I'm pretty much fluent. But that was a long struggle, you know, learned English. And then I had to like relearn Spanish. What a blow. Though one of the great things about being a person of color, an immigrant in this country, is there's always this sort of, there's a bar of authenticity that you're always slightly under.
Well, so speaking of becoming so interested in the English language and reading, what role did science fiction play in your acquisition of English? Did it have any role in your maintenance of Spanish?
Yeah, no, it's one of the things that happens with someone like me is that, like, I just love to read everything. Science fiction was particularly useful because it was one of these forms that kind of go on about this, but it's one of those forms that talks about kind of extreme experiences. As an immigrant kid, growing up in a time where there was not yet a proliferation of young adult immigrant books, there are now some books, you know, and they're quite good. At that time, science fiction and horror and fantasy seemed to be a lot more, I don't know, they seemed to correlate a lot more to my experiences of shifting worlds, of feeling like an alien, of sort of the sense of like being kind of tyrannized by some like past shadow of some terrible overlord, all the kind of standard tropes that you encounter about power, about domination, slavery, all these things were embedded and were just kind of woven through these narratives. And they kind of resonated with someone like me who comes out of a country that had been invaded multiple times, a country that had multiple genocides, a country that had been tyrannized by a figure in tremendous power. And it just made a lot of sense. And I think it helped at least give me language and lenses through which to look into the past and into the present. I mean, I come from a family where my mother constantly does not give all information. My mom is on the phone and she answers the phone and it's her sister, her sister will be like, oh, what are you doing? And my mom will say, I'm watching TV. My mom's not watching TV. My mom grew up in a dictatorship where you always lie 1 degree off because you don't want people to catch you. You don't want people to find you. You don't want people to know exactly what you're up to. And again, when I was reading these kind of texts, these kind of what we would call the fantastic genres, it just kind of explained me in a way that very little in realistic fiction did.
As an accomplished writer, Pulitzer Prize winning, with your books written in English and some Spanish colloquialisms thrown in for good measure, as I understand it, your mother speaks only Spanish and cannot really access your books in English.
No chance. Cannot.
I guess, how do you feel about this somewhat separation of something that's really important to you but creates the separation with you and your mother?
I don't know. I mean, it's welcome to it. I feel like this seems like the very typical Caribbean experience. You know, I mean, it feels very, very familiar. I mean, how many people came to the Caribbean speaking one language and their children spoke another one within a generation? I mean, this is not just something that only happens in America. You know, I think of all the South Asians who came to spread out throughout the Caribbean and, you know, they suddenly got caught speaking these weird patois and these weird Englishes, and they're like, man, how did this happen? I think that this is something that we don't give enough credence to and that we try to erase from the historical memory because we always like to imagine unbroken sort of links, culture, ethnicity, nation. But the truth of it is that there have been many people out there who they do not communicate with their parents in their parents' original language. And so I guess for me, I don't feel this to be sort of an aberration. I feel like this is, you know, part of what it means to be a Caribbean person, you know, part of the dislocation, the terrible dislocations that we've suffered. And again, my mother just waits for the translation to be done in Spanish. It's not as if I'm writing in Chinese. That might be very difficult. But English has been a part of the Caribbean experience for a very, very long time. And so has translation. I mean, for God's sake, I live on the island where literally the first border of the New World was created. where the translation is an absolute essential part for our island. I mean, I can't understand half my island unless somebody's translating. And so I guess these things all, you know, you can pin them on the larger national forces, but I have to tell you, or you can come up with these kind of vainglorious explanations, but I feel very comfortable with these things because I think because we have this grammar in us from a very long time.
Me dio una sirimba un domingo en la mañana cuando menos lo pensaba. Caí redondo como una guanábana sobre la alcantarilla. ¿Será la presión o me ha subido la bilirrubina? Y me entró una calentura y me fui poniendo blanco como bola.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Sari Gamethe, and we're featuring an interview with award-winning Dominican-American writer Juno Diaz. His latest novel is called This Is How You Lose Her. In the second half of this interview, we discussed his intersection of race, art, and politics.
As a Dominican-American writer, and you write about the experiences of Dominican-American men, and women too. Well, first, do you feel any unique challenges as a writer of color?
Well, yeah, I'm a writer of color in a country that tends to diminish people of color's contributions, whether they're diminishing them at the level of the nation, where we diminish the sort of contributions, the participations, the incredible hard work that our immigrants do, who have been totally racialized. When we think of immigrants these days, we never think of like Irish immigrants or Russian immigrants. They've completely always racialized. Or you're an artist who, you know, I mean, how many reviews do I get when I read them, where my artistry is diminished, where the actual critic will, without any evidence whatsoever, make claims like, oh, this is sort of his diary entries ripped out, as if the stories that I am writing, the sort of formalistic experimentation, the kind of structural rigor that I bring to my work, somehow resonates with a diary entry, like I'm on a street corner busting out raps. And I think it's kind of a traditional thing. It's and the same thing. It's like if I write about Dominican masculinity, it stands in for some sort of toxic, racialized machismo, and it is not seen and connected to sort of white masculinity, you know, and the kind of patriarchies we have in this country. And I think on top of that, there's just the most basic question of all. I'm sort of a writer of color who the average journalist comes in and says, so how has your otherness, how has this affected your writing? And I'm always like, yo, do you ask white writers this? Because last time I checked, and I, you know, it's true, and we say this again and again, last time I checked, a white writer's white privilege has more impact on their career than anything to do with my otherness, immigrantness, brownness, Africanness, you know, Dominicanness. So, you know, there's enormous amounts of challenges. I think what's really valuable is that we have an entirely different generation. I'm not writing in the 50s. I'm writing now where there's so many young people who are come out of these experiences, who are familiar with these worlds, who are hungry for this kind of language, and are seeing what I do as art, are responding to many of us as artists in the way that we are, who are valuing us. And I think that this, for me, despite this little, what I would call the nonsense, the crabitis that I have described, these challenges, it is an enormously exciting time to be a young artist of color. I mean, I'm 40, so I'm an old man, but certainly what I mean is, you know, in the larger sense, it's a great time to be doing work. And certainly we have a long way to go. Have we made enormous strides? Without any question. Is this a different time than the 1950s? No doubt. Are we still being unfairly hampered by all sorts of institutional and private prejudices? No question. I mean, it's always a challenge for every generation. We are not in a utopian society. The mm-hmm. best part of us is that everything we do well encourages a whole set of people of all colors to think differently, to operate differently, and to imagine differently. And that, to me, is why this gamble is so worth it. Every time somebody tries to get old reductive on me and try to simplify me into some sort of weird little category, I'm always like, man, there's a young kid who sends me an email and says, I'm an American Indian kid living in Montana, and I know nothing about the Dominican Republic, but your work really means the world to me. And it's like, it's taught me about how I can write in certain ways and how I can deploy languages and themes. You know, as a boy, I never thought I could write themes like about rape, themes about like sexual abuse. And, you know, that's deeply inspiring, even if it's only one email a year.
Do you ever feel you're obligated to discuss things like politics, harsh history of the Trujillo dictatorship, current contentious issues of immigration policies in this country?
I don't feel obligated. There's no reward. Listen, this is not a country that rewards you for being political, which is why the majority of our artists are apolitical. This is not a country that rewards you for being like raising issues that the country wants to ignore, which is why so much of our work has no real edge to it as far as race, as far as gender, as far as, you know, any kind of queerness about anything to do with class. I mean, listen, it's as if we have, it's for me, what I labor under is the real heavy obligation of this society to be silent. That's the obligation that I think is the one that I most have to soldier under, that I most find myself like pulling against and sort of fighting against. The idea that there's any impulse in this society that encourages an artist to approach, to articulate, to narrativize, to explore our taboos, I haven't seen it. I find the exact opposite problem. The thing is what happens is as long as you keep silent, no one notices. But if you raise any of these issues, suddenly you're a political writer, suddenly you're not really all that artistic, you're kind of some weird communist, you're just trying to do a moral sort of thing, you're pushing on issues. I've never felt an obligation to talk about Dominican history. I've always felt the exact opposite. But I think that it is quite possible to not only escape from this heavy burden that silences us, but to say things about the very themes and topics that we're told to avoid in a way that both enhances the art and also makes people eager to engage in it.
You know, in your books, you're writing about Dominican men and their experiences and their heavily flawed characters. Mm-hmm. And you even say, from the woman's perspective, stay away from Dominican men. You don't worry that you're painting or contributing to a stereotype about Dominican men or Latino men?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if all toxic masculinity is just a purvey of Dominican men, then wow, yeah, I probably am. But really what I'm doing is I'm using Dominican men to talk about masculinity. When these women, when Dominican women are saying stay away from Dominican men, or women who have the chance to deal with Dominican men, what is really being said beneath that? They're saying stay away from men. It's not as if we are the only ones who are up to this. And I think that what's interesting to me is how people kind of avoid the larger argument of the art. If anyone thinks that this argument is limited to Dominican men, then what they're basically saying is that the arguments in Macbeth are only limited to Scottish kings, or that the arguments in Moby Dick have only to do with people who are whalers, or that what's going on in William Faulkner is only related to certain kind of Southerners, sort of collapsing, slumping aristocracies. And again, this is a way that people attempt to silence a conversation. I don't care. I don't mind running the risk that people think I'm somehow increasing the sum total of stereotypes against Dominicans. I find that highly improbable. Increase the stereotype in this country about black people. Increase it. I'd love to see this. I'd love somebody to add to the stereotypes around immigrants. I would love to see that happen, that an individual has the kind of power to add a few teardrops into the ocean and to raise the level. I mean, that's what we're talking about. But for me, these sort of, I think, kind of lame-ass arguments are there to avoid what's really being said, is that I'm just using Dominican masculinity, a local masculinity, the same way that Shakespeare used a local Regency to talk about the larger human condition. And somehow, when it comes to people like me, we suddenly lose perspective that these things are metaphors and suddenly become incredibly literal, as if I'm writing sociology and not art. Listen, plenty of white writers have tackled race. This is an old, old custom. You always know when a white writer is doing their race book. suddenly black people are major characters or an Asian person's a major character. You know, you always know the race book. But for some of us, the race book is every book because we understand that race is not something that you can suddenly wish away or that suddenly is like, oh, it's time to do this. That race is as much a part of our culture as gravity is to our physical reality. And I guess I'm not buying this, all these attempts that people make to silence conversation. Because what I think is there's difference between me victimizing people through racist generalities versus me using people's racist generalities to attempt to have a discussion about the way race works. Now, is there a fine line between that? Yes. Am I willing to take all the criticism that people have? Yes. That's why I'm an artist. I'm an artist not because I think that I can do something with no responsibility. I'm an artist because I think whatever I stake out, whoever wants to respond is allowed to. And they're going to respond as legitimately and as illegitimately they want. And this is part of the conversation. Now, I could be wrong, but the future will tell. And I think this is the power of art, is art doesn't work across demographic lines. When it comes time to interpret art, to talk about art, you suddenly realize how locked in we are to our formulas. But I tend to write art from the point of a reader. And a reader is a terrible nationalist. A terrible nationalist. A reader is a terrible partisan. We cross party lines. We jump borders. We smuggle ourselves into other people's houses. We smuggle ourselves into other people's pants. We smuggle ourselves into other people's just everything, their castles. We're terrible this way. You know, we're like a mongoose nation, super fast and doesn't obey. And so I don't know, I guess from a reader's perspective, I always imagine that in fact, sometimes distance, sometimes the fact that you don't know, the fact that this isn't written for you, makes it all the more precious. Yeah, it's become something found and something that you adopt. I guess I've always been one of those people who thinks that we can love something we adopt as much as we can love something that we've given birth to. And I think reading teaches that every day.
I have one last question. Your characters in your books have these so-called nerdy interests, which are assumed to be, you know, unique to Dominican men. And I'm not going to lie, I didn't grow up on comic books. Star Wars, but not comic books. So I had to jump to the Wikipedia to
sure
fully appreciate some references, but that was my choice. One thing, are you planning to write a science fiction book in the future?
Yeah. I mean, I would say nerdiness is not characteristic of Dominican men as generally formulated. I mean, Dominican men are like, our formula, the formula we're taught to be, is about as far away from a nerd as possible. But I am trying to write a science fiction book, a book called Monstro, and it's supposed to be about a sort of an alien invasion from the inside, an alien invasion that grows out of us. But again, it's a book that's taken forever. I suck. I write slow. And, you know, I'm always sort of wrestling with myself. If I can finish a chapter in a year, that would be, like, fast. But then again, I don't know if I can write it. I mean, I'm always amazed how confident other writers are, that they just write work and they'll jump to a different genre and they'll do it and they'll do it beautifully. I'm far more doubting, Nagata. I'm far more doubting. I'm the kind of guy who's like, you know, I actually don't know if I can do it because I sort of have such, I don't want to say high standards because that's so self-serving, but I would say strict standards. If it doesn't come in to a certain acceptable level, then I'll just kind of just cashier it. So I don't know. I hope it finishes. I would love to have a book about an apocalyptic monster invasion in the Dominican Republic. It would be like a homecoming.
That's everything I have. Do you have any last remarks?
No, thank you. I mean, thank you. You know, I it's one of those things. We spend many, many years working in absolute silence. And so then we come out and we talk about books and we talk about our motivations. We talk about these things. And none of this really is authoritative. Even though it's coming from the writer, I don't understand 99% of what I do. And a lot of this sort of ideas that I have around it tend to be gestures at an understanding, but not a real understanding. I think at the end, the reader, and I'm not just saying this, I believe it, I think the reader is the one who can best answer any of these questions. I'm just sort of holding the place, keeping the seat warm until they get to it.
Juno Diaz, thank you so much for chatting with me at KBOO.
Thank you.
That was Pulitzer Prize winning author Juno Diaz.
Juno is also a professor of writing at MIT. His latest novel is called This Is How You Lose Her, a work of fiction which deconstructs a cheater. This interview was recorded back in September. Since then, Juno Diaz has been recognized for a number of accolades, including the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. You can learn more about his work at junodiaz.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
Next up on KBOO, a special encore presentation of an installment of Black Book Talk. Today, the guest is author and academic Dr. David Imhotep, who discusses his book, The First Americans Were Africans, which asserts that Africans were the first Americans and that they arrived 51,000 years prior to the Mongolians. Also, thanks, listeners, and thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. You keep us strong. Black Book Talk is up next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater presents a monthly film series on the second Thursday of each month. January 10th at 7 p.m., we present the 1988 film Talk Radio, in which a rude, contemptuous talk show host becomes overwhelmed by the hatred that surrounds his program just before it goes national.
Open your mouth and tell them what we're going to do about the mess this country's in. Talk radio. It's the last neighborhood in town. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Let's go to the first caller. Night Talk.
Before Agnes, the film, yeah. We'll hear Carl Wilson, who will talk about his experience as a talk show host in Portland. And the film will be introduced by a KBOO board member and Wednesday morning talk show host, Lisa Loving. That's January 10th at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll to the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to the September edition of Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
Along with O.B. Hill, Reflections, Mirror Image Books.
And our guest today is Dr. David M. Hoftep, and he is the author of The First Americans Were Africans. Welcome to the show, Dr. M. Hoftep.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi. Would you gift us with a reading from the book so we can set the stage for our listeners?
Okay. The